Welcome back to Counting to Five, a podcast about the United States Supreme Court. This episode is something of a relaunch after a very extended hiatus, so first, a few quick words about that. After our first several episodes back in the fall, we decided the format and schedule weren't working out quite as we had hoped. We've taken some time to regroup and retool, and now we're back with a new format. Stick around at the end of the episode for more about the direction this podcast will be taking going forward. In this episode, we're going to take a big picture look at the court's current term, what's happened so far, where we are now, and what we can expect between now and the end of June. And we'll also take a quick look at a few of the term's highest profile cases. The Supreme Court's term officially starts each year on the first Monday in October. Normally, for 2 weeks each month from October through April, the court hears oral arguments in its cases, and then issues all of its opinions for the term by the end of June. The justices then go their separate ways for the summer and reconvene in late September, shortly before the start of the new October term. The court wrapped up its final oral arguments for the term in the last week of April, and now the court has just 6 weeks left to get all of its opinions issued before its self-imposed deadline at the end of June. The court heard argument in a total of 64 cases this term. As of this episode, the court has issued decisions in exactly half of those cases, which means we can expect 32 more between now and the end of June. As of the start of the term, it looked like the court was on track to have a light year. The court heard only between 7 and 9 cases in each of its first 5 oral argument sessions from October through February, but as the term progressed, the court filled out its docket and backloaded the term with 11 and 13 arguments in the March and April sessions, respectively. In the end, with 64 decisions expected, the court will end up in the same rough ballpark as in recent years in terms of total decisions issued. The biggest news for the court this term has been the addition of Neil Gorsuch as the newest justice, bringing the court's membership back to a full 9 after more than a year with an empty seat. After Justice Scalia's unexpected death in February 2016, President Obama nominated D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals Chief Judge Merrick Garland as Scalia's replacement. But even prior to Garland's nomination, Senate Republicans, led by Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, announced that they would not hold a hearing for any nominee until after the 2016 election. The Republican majority was able to maintain a unified front, and in the end, Garland's nomination expired without Senate confirmation at the close of the Senate session in early January 2017, and a few short weeks later, Obama was succeeded by President Trump. On January 31st of this year, Trump nominated Neil Gorsuch, then a judge on the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals, for the court's vacant seat. In doing this, he fulfilled a campaign promise to select the new justice from a list of 21 names provided by his campaign. Politicians and interest groups divided on the Gorsuch nomination, largely along partisan lines. The Senate confirmation hearing began on March 20th and ran for 4 days. Gorsuch faced aggressive questioning from a number of Democratic senators, while Republican senators played a more supportive role. On April 3rd, the Senate Judiciary Committee sent the nomination to the full Senate on a straight party-line vote. At that point, the confirmation process took a very unusual, though highly anticipated, turn. Republicans currently hold 52 seats in the Senate. The remaining 48 seats are held by Democrats or independents who caucus with the Democrats. According to Senate procedures in effect at the time, in order to allow a final confirmation vote on a Supreme Court nominee, at least 60 senators needed to vote to approve what's known as a cloture motion, which cuts off further debate. That means that a coordinated minority of 41 senators could hold open debate on the nomination, preventing a final vote from taking place. This is the modern filibuster. On April 6th, a cloture vote was held for the Gorsuch nomination, and 44 Democrats voted against, successfully, though temporarily, blocking a confirmation vote. The Republican majority responded by exercising what has come to be known as the nuclear option, amending the Senate rules by a simple majority party-line vote to eliminate the 60-vote cloture requirement. With the filibuster eliminated, a final confirmation vote was held the following day, and with 3 Democratic senators joining the Republicans and 1 Republican absent for medical reasons, Gorsuch was confirmed by a vote of 54-45. Because Gorsuch was confirmed on April 7th, he joined the court in time for the final oral argument session of the term, which began just over a week later on April 17th. The court heard 13 cases in the April argument session, and because the court attempts to evenly distribute majority opinions for each session among the justices, we should expect to see 1 or 2 Gorsuch majority opinions this term, and possibly additional concurring or dissenting opinions in other cases. The Supreme Court's practice is that a new justice doesn't participate in the decision of any case that was argued before that justice took the bench, so all of the outstanding cases heard through the March sitting are expected to be issued by the pre-Gorsuch 8-member court. If, however, the justices are evenly divided 4-4 in any of those cases, the court would likely order the case to be re-argued, which would allow Justice Gorsuch to participate and break the tie. We won't know for sure which, if any, of those cases will split 4-4 until all of the decisions for the term are out. So far, this term has been a relatively low-profile one, without any of the huge blockbuster cases that the court has decided in recent years, like, for example, the several Affordable Care Act cases and the same-sex marriage cases. The court did hear a number of interesting, though lower-visibility cases, in contentious areas like immigration, intellectual property, election redistricting, and the intersection of race and the criminal justice system. And as always, the court this term heard a number of highly technical procedural cases that typically draw very little attention. The two highest-profile cases of the term are probably Trinity Lutheran Church of Columbia v. Comer and Lee v. Tam, both of which are still outstanding. Let's take a quick look at each of them now. Trinity Lutheran Church involves the always controversial intersection of government and religion. The basic facts of the case are fairly straightforward. Trinity Lutheran is a Missouri church that operates an on-site preschool and daycare center with a playground. The state of Missouri's Scrap Tire Grant Program provides grants to reimburse nonprofits for the cost of rubber playground surfacing made from recycled tires. The grants are funded by a fee imposed on the sale of new tires. In theory, the program serves the dual purposes of making playgrounds safer for children and keeping used tires out of landfills. In 2012, Trinity Lutheran submitted an application to the Scrap Tire Grant Program. Because funding for the program was limited, applicants were ranked according to a set of neutral criteria, including such things as whether the applicant has a detailed plan for the installation of the new playground surfacing. Trinity Lutheran was ranked 5th out of 44 total applicants. Funds were available to reimburse 14 applicants, which would have appeared to make Trinity Lutheran eligible. The state, however, excluded Trinity Lutheran from receiving the funds, citing a Missouri state constitutional provision that says, quote, "No money shall ever be taken from the public treasury, directly or indirectly, in aid of any church, sect, or denomination of religion." The state argues that this constitutional provision and its decision to exclude Trinity Lutheran are justified by the state's legitimate interests in avoiding preferential treatment to any particular religious denomination, respecting taxpayers' consciences, and protecting religious institutions from government intrusion that might come along with the provision of funds. The church, on the other hand, argues that by barring it from participating in a generally available secular program, it is being discriminated against solely because of its religious character. The court heard oral argument in this case on April 19th and is expected to issue a decision by the end of June. This was one of the 13 cases heard after Justice Gorsuch joined the court, so he will be participating in the court's decision. The other high-profile case is Lee v. Tam. Simon Tam is the lead singer of an all-Asian-American rock band called The Slants. According to Tam, The Slants chose their band name in order to reclaim and reappropriate a word that is widely viewed as a pejorative term for persons of East Asian ancestry. But when Tam sought to trademark The Slants' name, the Patent and Trademark Office, the PTO, denied their trademark, finding it disparaging to persons of Asian ancestry, citing a statutory provision that bars trademarks for, quote, "matter which may disparage or falsely suggest a connection with persons living or dead, institutions, beliefs, or national symbols, or bring them into contempt or disrepute." Tam appealed the PTO's decision to the Federal Circuit Court of Appeals, arguing that the bar on disparaging trademarks violates the First Amendment's protection of freedom of speech by discriminating against certain trademarks on the basis of the message they convey. The federal government argues that denying trademark registration doesn't actually restrict Tam's speech because nothing prevents The Slants from continuing to use their name, just without the benefits of a registered trademark, and that the government has a legitimate interest in not placing its stamp of approval on disparaging marks. First Amendment cases, especially those involving potentially offensive speech, tend to attract a lot of attention, but this case has had an extra spotlight because of the ongoing litigation challenging the Washington Redskins trademark under the same statutory provision. If the Supreme Court rules in favor of The Slants, that would likely spell the end of the lawsuit against the Redskins as well. The Supreme Court heard oral argument in this case on January 18th and is expected to issue a decision by the end of June. I plan to discuss both Trinity Lutheran and Lee v. Tam in more depth in future episodes. Earlier this term, it looked like the court would be deciding another very high-profile case, Gloucester County School Board v. G.G. This was a case involving the highly contentious issue of access to single-sex bathroom facilities by transgender individuals. The initials G.G. refer to Gavin Grimm, a student at Gloucester High School in Gloucester, Virginia. Grimm is a transgender male, which is to say he was designated as female at birth, but later came to self-identify as male. At the start of his sophomore year, Grimm publicly transitioned to a male gender identity, adopting the name Gavin. The school responded by changing his name in their records and instructing teachers to address him by his new name and using male pronouns. Grimm initially used a private restroom, but was soon given permission by the high school principal to use the male restroom. In response to parent complaints and after public hearings, the school board responded by adopting a new policy, which required that the use of restroom and locker room facilities, quote, shall be limited to the corresponding biological genders, and students with gender identity issues shall be provided an alternative appropriate private facility. Grimm brought a lawsuit against the school board alleging a violation of Title IX, which bars discrimination on the basis of sex under any education program or activity receiving federal financial assistance. Title IX contains an exception, however, allowing schools to maintain, quote, separate living facilities for the different sexes, and a Department of Education regulation first enacted in 1975 interprets this to mean that schools, quote, may provide separate toilet, locker room, and shower facilities on the basis of sex. So the key issue in this litigation is how transgender individuals fit into this statutory and regulatory scheme. The Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit ruled for Grimm, holding that he must be allowed to use the male restroom, but its decision rested on a 2015 opinion letter from the Department of Education, which interpreted the word sex in the regulation permitting separate toilet facilities to mean gender identity. The Supreme Court agreed to hear the case, and one of the issues it agreed to decide was whether the lower court was right to defer to the Department of Education's 2015 opinion letter. In late February, however, in a move that was not entirely unexpected but nevertheless highly controversial, the Department of Education, under the new Trump administration, rescinded the 2015 opinion letter, removing the basis for the Fourth Circuit's decision. The Supreme Court decided to respond to this change in circumstances by sending the case back down to the Fourth Circuit for essentially a do-over to decide how the case should come out without any deference to the now-rescinded opinion letter. And that's where the case currently stands. Of course, once the Fourth Circuit does issue a new opinion, whichever party loses will most likely ask the Supreme Court to take the case again, so it may find its way back on the court's docket before long. This case is much more complicated than this brief summary lets on. Central to the story, as it's played out so far, is a seemingly dry and technical legal doctrine known as auer deference, which is the key to understanding the significance of the 2015 opinion letter and its later withdrawal. But unraveling the full story will have to wait for a future episode. And that brings us to the end of Episode 5. Links to resources and documents related to this episode can be found in the show notes at countingto5.com. That's T-O and the number 5. Please check it out if you're interested. As I mentioned at the top of the episode, with this relaunch, we're moving to a different format based around shorter, more focused episodes. We're planning a variety of future episodes covering different aspects of the court and its work, including upcoming cases, issued opinions, individual justices, the court's practices and procedures, court history, and the confirmation process. But exactly what we end up covering depends largely on the feedback we get from listeners like you. We want to know what you want to hear. Is there a particular case or legal subject matter that you want to hear about? Do you have a question about the court or one of the justices? Let us know, and this will help us shape the podcast going forward. Questions, comments, thoughts, suggestions, requests, complaints, any feedback you have, I would love to hear it. You can leave a comment on the show notes post at countingto5.com or on the Counting to 5 Facebook page, tweet at countingto5, or send an email to mike@countingto5.com. I look forward to hearing from you. In our next episode, we're going to take a brief look at two other cases, Visa Inc. v. Osborne and Ivy v. Morath. These cases were on the court's docket at the start of the term, but both were dismissed by the court prior to oral argument, although for very different reasons. We're going to take a look at why and how the court got rid of these cases and what that tells us about how the court operates. I hope you'll join me. Thank you for listening. This has been Counting to Five.